Buying or selling your home? Real Estate for Life can connect you with a pro-life real estate agent. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 65% to Catholic Answers. Learn more at realestateforlife.org. Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kelly, your host. Delighted to be back here on a Monday. It's always good to be back here on a Monday. Thank you very much for being here with us. We have a very good show for you. Second hour, we've got Mark Brumley coming up, and we'll do Ask Me Anything with Mark Brumley. Mark Brumley, of course, president of Ignatius Press, and one of the greatest guys. And one of the greatest publishing houses, as we like to say, the most important publishing house in the Alpha Quadrant. This hour, we're going to talk about bioethics. And I always like when we have the opportunity to let people just call with their bioethical questions, whether you work in the field, maybe the field of nursing or medicine more generally, or you're a scientist. You are welcome to call 888-318-7884. Or if you maybe you have end-of-life issues or caring for the sick issues that are part of your own life or family, you too are welcome to call 888-318-7884. Our guest is Father Tad Poholcik. You know Father Tad. He's been a regular guest here for a long time on Catholic Answers Live, but you know him from all over Catholic media as well, from the National Catholic Bioethics Center. Father Tad Poholcik, thank you very much for being here with us.
Great to be able to join you, Cy. Thanks so much.
I'm sorry I'm not having a good hair day. I don't know if you see this, but it is a rough hair day for me. So I'll do my best. It doesn't really matter that much for radio, but how's everything at the National Catholic Bioethics Center? You're there in Philadelphia. That's right, right? You're still in Philadelphia?
Yeah. Philadelphia, that's correct. Yes, things are going well. You know, the summer is steaming along. There's never a lack of interesting things for us to attend to, as you can imagine.
I kind of wish there would be sometimes. News.
I know what you mean. It's true. There was that news about the Bioethics Center in Oxford, the Catholic one, the Anscombe Center, closing down recently. And, you know, we were saddened to see that. I think we should be seeing more bioethics centers popping up here and there, and not fewer and fewer, you know?
Yes, we should, and especially because we can't just do this stuff intuitively. I think moral intuition is important and it's helpful, but there are such fine distinctions to be made with this very advanced science being applied to human persons that we can't just rely on give it your best shot.
You know, I agree. I think the tendency is to kind of say, oh, that generates a sense of repugnance for me, or that makes me feel uncomfortable, and therefore it must not be ethical, kind of thing. And, you know, I understand that that's sometimes true. You know, our moral intuition kind of covers a lot of ground and overlaps at times with feelings, but that's not a methodology. It's not an approach. I think we need to instead approach these matters from the vantage point of what are the objective goods that are at stake and what goods need to be defended, like human dignity and, you know, the value of the human person, et cetera. And with those, then you can sort of chart a course that makes some sense.
I'm glad we have you to help us do that, Father, because I have to say, I sometimes recoil from some of the things in the news. You kind of like, it's piercing in a way. You feel like, sometimes it's just because of that thing that you were saying you might have a kind of reflex against it, but also, some of the things that are being done are horrible, and some of the things that are being done are just frankly confusing. And so you end up just like, I can't deal with this. And so I want to give you one. I want to present you with I'm sure that everybody has asked you about the case of Adriana Smith in Georgia. Young woman, pregnant with, I believe, her second child, developed blood clots of the brain and died. But at least that's my understanding. You're going to have to correct me if I get the facts wrong. But doctors, she was already on life support and breathing apparatus and all that. And so they would not, my understanding is they wouldn't take her off of it and they wouldn't consult with the family about it because their understanding of Georgia law was that it would be tantamount to aborting the child if they were to do that. And abortion's illegal after a heartbeat is detected. And this child was well past that point of pregnancy. So this became controversial because I think that the family was not consulted. Nobody said, do you want us to do this or not do this? And I frankly find it a very difficult case. I know I sometimes am scared to talk about these things with you because I've read you go, no, it's an easy one. Here's the easy. And then I'll be like, oh, well, it seemed hard to me at the time. But this one actually seems difficult to me, Father. So let me just ask you, first of all, if I got the facts generally right, and then what are the principles that need to come into play here?
Yeah, you did get the facts right. I mean, it was actually a very good summary, I think, that you gave of what happened in her case. And so the question that has been raised, I mean, it's probably worth mentioning what happened in the case. So she continued to be maintained for a fairly extended period. I think it was, you know, a few months, which is remarkable because you can't always maintain these kinds of pregnancies despite your best efforts. Once the mother has died, it's very difficult. It takes a lot of interventions, you know, a lot of blood pressure meds and heating pads and, you know, other things to just kind of keep this body going with the baby inside. And yet they were able to do that, apparently to the point that then they were able to deliver the baby by a C-section. And very early, very premature, I think the baby was only like 1 pound, 8 ounces or something, but alive and seems to be doing well. They think the prospects are good. And then I don't know how much after that C-section, how many days after, but they then turned off the ventilator and they recently had the funeral for the mother as well. So that's how it ended up. And I think, you know, the discomfort, if you will, around this case, I've heard people say things like, well, this is tantamount to abuse of a corpse or something like that.
Right.
You know, this shouldn't be allowed, that kind of thing. And I think that really misses a lot of most of the nuance of a case like this.
Yeah.
I think it fails to really draw, you know, on the essential questions around a tragic occurrence like this, where the mom dies, but the child is still alive.
Well, I was surprised at this because here in the United States, you would never think that something like this would happen, but people politicize this. It's surprising to have shocking that a case involving reproduction would be politicized here in the United States.
Right.
And
can you imagine?
I know, right? It's shocking. But I found a tremendous amount of the commentary had to do with, you know, all kinds of people's fantasies, but did not have to do with Adriana Smith and her child. It had to do with whatever political axe people had to grind. But I want to ask you a couple things about this because I can't clarify these in my mind. The Georgia hospital said that it would be tantamount to abortion if they had taken the mother off the ventilator. That seems to me to be not true. I don't understand how that can be true because no one at any point here is directly attacking an innocent child.
Right. I think you're correct on that. It's not, I mean, for them to say tantamount to an abortion, I think it depends what they mean by tantamount. But in other words, it's clear that the child will die shortly thereafter, but it does not constitute a direct attack on the integrity of the child or his or her body. In this case, it was a little boy named Chance. Yeah, interesting name. Give Chance a chance kind of thing. So it's not really fair, I think, to use abortion language directly here. I think the question has to be formulated differently in terms of the moral contours and to say something like, is it the case that it is, unreasonable to attempt to continue to maintain the vital or semi-vital functions of the mother's body on behalf of her unborn baby now that mom is deceased. That's a fair question, and that has it doesn't immediately draw on the abortion language, which I think, as you point out, doesn't fit well.
888-318-7884 is the number, by the way. If you'd like to get involved in this conversation or you have your own bioethics questions, you are welcome to call 888-318-7884. Father, I want to push on something else here. And because I just do not have the philosophical framework in my brain to understand this. But it seems to me that when the body is doing what the body is supposed to do, it's alive. And when it's not in an organized, I can see how you could die and your skin cells are still alive for a good long period after you die. And so you're just having cells living doesn't mean that the organizing principle of the body is there anymore. But it does seem to me that if the work of producing a child, if you have such high functioning in the body that the child is actually being nourished and developed and actually formed. I mean, the child is formed out of the stuff of the mother. You know, its own cells are made from what it takes from from the mother through the umbilical cord. How can we say that this woman is not alive?
Well, I think what we can say is that the integrating principle that allows her to function autonomously is clearly not present. I mean, she died, she had the stroke, she is in a situation of continuing disorganization that's, you know, getting worse and worse. If you don't step in with more and more interventions to control the blood pressure, to adjust the electrolytes, to, you know, maintain body temperature, which is not going to be regulated, functions. I mean, you know, everything's pulling apart at the seams here, and Adriana's body is kind of spinning out of control. But the doctors are coming in from the right and from the left and from the top and the bottom and just doing this and doing that and trying their darndest to keep this system that's falling apart from falling apart too quickly. Now, I say system in the sense that it's not, you know, really a system that's operating well. It's a system that's in its final kind of spiral of decay. Yeah. And we have a lot of powerful tools that are available to us to be able to kind of shift the momentum here one direction or the other, even in a situation where you're dealing with an individual who's deceased, like her, you know, somebody who's functionally really a corpse.
Okay.
You know, you can do quite a bit, but you can't do everything. And that's why these pregnancies, when there's a genuine situation of brain death, very often you cannot shuttle them for a couple of months to the point of viability. It just won't work. You know, the body is too out of kilter to be able to do that.
So just one question before we go to the break then, and that is this, that was the hospital, it seems to me that you are an advocate for the hospital in this sense, that you think they did the right thing in this situation. You can correct me if I'm wrong about that. But was the hospital obligated to do this, or was this did they go above and beyond in order to try to preserve the life of the child? That is, would any hospital in a similar situation be obligated to undertake this, or is this a special circumstance, really an extraordinary endeavor?
Well, it certainly involves some unusual interventions that you typically would not do after you had declared somebody brain dead. But you see, the way this has to be analyzed, I believe, is to say, when you have a pregnant woman under normal circumstances, you have two patients that you are ministering to, that you are attempting to provide medical treatment and healing. But if the mother dies, there's only one patient left. And that means that your focus of attention should be directed to that single patient who remains. And then the question becomes, all right, is it reasonable here to think that the mom would want for this kind of set of interventions to be done using her body in this way? And I like to remind people, look, people do many different things with their bodies after death. You can donate your body to science. It can be used for ballistics research. You can use it for medical research. And think about a mother in particular. You know, she's already invested some serious time here into this pregnancy, hoping that this beautiful child will see the light of day. And so probably, you know, she was being careful about the alcohol and, you know, being sure to eat well and do things on behalf of the child. So is it reasonable that she would want to continue to take steps to support her child even after she was died, even after she had died? And the answer, I think, would be yes. And I mean, the other example I use that I think is a fair example is to say, what if you had a mother who was holding her newborn in her arms, all right, the baby had already been born, and she spies off, you know, a few feet away, a guy who's pulling out a handgun and pointing it at her and her baby. What would she do? I think she would turn her back into the path of the bullet and take the bullet on behalf of her child. That's what it is, you know, to be a mom, to make sacrifices on behalf of your child. So to think that, you know, after a mother had died, that she wouldn't be desirous of donating the only thing she has left for the benefit of her child, it just seems to me to make a lot of sense.
Father Tad Boholcik is our guest from the National Catholic Bioethics Center. If you have bioethics questions, you are welcome to call 888-318-7884. You can get in on this conversation that we are having about this case of Adriana Smith in Georgia and her son, Chase. Or if you have another question, maybe you have a beginning of life question, maybe you have an end of life question, maybe you have a question about caring for someone who is disabled or in distress in some other way, you are very welcome to call with your bioethics questions, 888-318-7884.
Catholic Answers Live.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Magnificat. Published monthly, Magnificat features texts of daily mass, prayers, articles, meditations, art commentaries, and more, in step with the liturgical rhythm of the Church, on the web at Magnificat.com.
Hi, this is Father Mike Schmitz. I invite you to listen to Bible in a Year and Catechism in a Year here on EWTN Radio. On Bible in a Year, we're reading all the way from Genesis through Revelation, plus time for explanations and reflections to help us go deeper into God's Word, encounter His voice, and learn how to live life through the lens of Scripture.
Bible in a Year and Catechism in a Year with Father Mike Schmitz, tonight at 10 p.m. Eastern, 7 p.m. Pacific on EWTN Radio.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. The number is 888-318-7884. Second hour, Mark Brumley will be here with us from Ignatius Press. And if you'd like to ask Mark a question, we'll do Ask Me Anything with Mark Brumley. And you can ask him anything. He's so smart. Father Tad Boholcik is our guest from the National Catholic Bioethics Center. You can go to ncbcenter.org to find out more about the National Catholic Bioethics Center, or you can seek their help if you have a bioethics issue that you need help with. You can go to FatherTad.com if you would like more information about what Father Tad does. You want to read his writings, you want to see his videos, FatherTad.com. He was going to do FatherPoholcik.com, but no one would be able to find that website, so he went with FatherTad.com. That's true, isn't it?
Well, I'm afraid it is. You're spot on.
Yeah, right. Well, how many people are going to visit FatherPoholcik.com? They'll give up after like the first three letters. They'll be, I can't. I'm not going to be able to.
These Polish names with all consonants, you know?
Yeah. Are they hard for the Polish people, though? Like, are they like, yeah, the whole world has these easy names. Or are the Poles like, I don't know how to spell your name, you know, whatever your Polish name is.
I think the Polish people, it comes very easy for them. I'm always impressed. And, you know, I remember when I was a student in Rome, the Polish seminarians, because their own language is such a hard one, I think they picked up Italian much quicker than the Americans did.
Oh, yeah. It was probably a relief to them. They were probably like, this is the easiest language to speak. It doesn't have any fucking in it. 888-318-7884 is the number. Father Tad Poholchik, our guest. We'll start on the phones in Omaha, Nebraska. And James is listening where everybody in Omaha, Nebraska listens. Spirit Catholic Radio. Glad to have you, James. Go ahead with your question.
Good evening, Cy Kellett, as Father Poholchik. I had sort of a comparative analysis of like the case in Georgia versus a hypothetical case that we could think of with IVF. So as we know, with IVF, embryos are fertilized and then left to kind of float around in the ether in a freezer until somebody picks them up. So in the cases where parents can't pay to store them or anything like that, is there any sort of ethical limitation or reasonable, amount of work ethic that we could expect of someone to not encourage them to like take in an embryo and gestate it? You know, should we be going after every possible avenue to rescue embryos, or is there an amount of ethical, you know, dilemma there that we could reasonably be like, we don't need to worry about these IVF embryos. Let's just baptize them and let them die. So kind of a comparative there, I guess.
Okay.
Wow. That's a loaded question, James. And there's about actually five questions in there. Let me just maybe start at the back end where you finished with baptism and just, well, we need, you know, could we just baptize and sort of thaw them out and dispatch the matter? I think even that is not actually a clear type of an answer or solution, in the sense that doing the baptism is itself going to cause the death of the embryos. Because if you use water, embryos cannot grow in water. They require, you know, an ionically balanced solution with nutrients and so on to be able to grow. So if you take them out of the freezer and you put them down and sort of pour water over them, and you're likely going to be the cause of their death. And I am convinced that sacraments are not supposed to cause people's death. I mean, I'll give you it's somewhat of a crazy example, but I think you'll see the parallel here. You know, if you had a situation where you had a newborn baby that was sort of trapped deep in the ground, and you weren't able to rescue him. He's in some deep hole, no tools available. And you said, well, let's just pour a bunch of water down there and drown the baby. But in so doing, say the words of baptism. I think, you know, that would be another example. It's a little bit absurd, but where I don't think sacraments are meant to be done in that fashion, that it causes the demise of the person receiving the sacrament because of the sacrament. So having said that, you know, just to back up then a little bit further, you're asking, you know, what are reasonable sorts of steps that one might be able to take on behalf of embryos that have been produced by in vitro fertilization and more or less abandoned in the freezer? I mean, is there a duty, first of all, for the parents to circle back and for mom to try to implant her own embryos, you know, especially in cases where maybe she's now much older, past menopause, and there isn't any likelihood of, you know, achieving a state of pregnancy, or very, very low likelihood, even with all the tools of science. I think here that there certainly are real obligations that parents have towards their children in the freezer, because it was the parents' fault that they ended up in the freezer. It was the parents' decision to bring them into the world in this extremely awkward and morally problematic fashion, so that the children have no clear path out of the dilemma that they find themselves in the deep freeze. And I mean, does this mean, though, that the mom should implant? I'm convinced that this would not be allowable. And I'm especially convinced that it would not be allowable for the family to transfer these embryos to others to implant and gestate them as if they were their own, this so-called embryo adoption proposal that's been out there. And if you look up Section 19 of Dignitas Personae, it was a document, I think it was, if I recall correctly, 96 that it came out. I'm not sure on that year. But Section 19 has language that I think is pretty clear that embryo adoption is, in its core, a no-go approach here. And so this leaves the awkward question of, well, you have these embryos that are trapped in the deep freeze. Is there anything that can be done with them? And in terms of, you know, what are parental obligations, I deal with couples who are in this situation and they ask me, what should we do? I'll say, well, these are your kids. You do have some responsibility here to continue to try to care for them and maybe set up a trust fund so that you can pay the fees for freezing to continue so they don't die. So very awkward, as you can see.
James, thank you so much. Lots more calls. You're welcome to call 888-31-TRUTH. Right back. Each Catholic is obliged to spread and defend the faith by word and deed. Well, we're here to help. Join special guests Chris Stefanik, Dr. David Anders, Steve Dawson, and all your favorite Catholic Answers apologists this September 25th through 28th in beautiful San Diego for the Catholic Answers Conference. Our theme? Go make disciples. Enjoy 4 days of faith, fun, and fellowship. Use promo code EARLY to save $50 when you register today at CatholicAnswersConference.com.
Lots of people have big questions about Catholicism. It needs a big book of answers, and now it's got one. The Big Book of Catholic Answers is filled with helpful replies to more than 250 questions about the faith. Questions about God, salvation history, the Creed, the Bible, the list goes on and on. Order your copy of the Big Book of Catholic Answers today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
We hope that one of the things that we communicate here at Catholic Answers Live is that our Catholic faith allows us to be fully serious about all the problems we encounter in the church and in the world, but it also lets us have light hearts and maybe even mix in a bit of fun, and that is exactly what our good friend Joe Heschmeyer does in his popular podcast, Shameless Popery. You should check it out at shamelessjoe.com. Joe's got a deep grasp of the faith, of morals, the teachings of the church, all that. But he's also got a witty conversational style. He entertains and he informs. But you will leave equipped to better answer the most common challenges, misconceptions, and questions about the Catholic faith. He's got insightful guests. He does on-air debates. And he takes a close look into all the things that you want to know about as a Catholic living today. You'll walk away knowledgeable and filled with joy. Look for Joe on his YouTube channel. Check him out at shamelessjoe.com or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like what you hear, become a patron. Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. We'd love it if you'd come on our Rhine River cruise next year. You've got all the way till May to pack and plan and all that stuff, because next year in May, Father Sebastian Walsh will be our chaplain, the author of Secrets from Heaven, about the parables and sayings of Jesus Christ. Joe Heschmeyer will be among the guests. I'll be there. Chris Check, our president, will be there. And we'll start in Amsterdam and end in Basel, and you will see some of the most important Christian sites in Europe, some of the most important Christian sites in history. If you'd like to find out more about it, just go to CatholicCruise.com. Please do find out more about it. We'd love it if you'd come. CatholicCruise.com. The whole boat will be Catholic Answers people. So it's up to you to decide whether that's a good thing or a bad thing. We think it's a good thing. CatholicCruise.com. Father Tad Poholchik is our guest this hour. Father is at the National Catholic Bioethics Center and really one of the leading voices, certainly one of the leading public voices to help us understand how the principles of the moral life given to us by both reason and revelation apply to the new technologies, which we call biotech. And if you have a question about how to do that, that's a bioethics question, and we'd be happy to take it. 888-318-7884. Richard is in Illinois. Richard, you are next. Go ahead with your question for Father Tad.
Thank you. I wanted to round back to the pregnant lady in Georgia
that okay.
was brain dead. I came up with an idea, you know, that this is a fairly new medical procedure to keep someone alive or their vitals alive when they've passed, that maybe wasn't around 20, 30 years ago. Since this is available, should it be asked to a pregnant woman if they want this to be available to them?
I see.
Similarly, yeah. when they came up with the complication is there's two persons involved. I understand that. Similar to, you know, when they invented resuscitation. Now hospitals will ask, do you want to be resuscitated? But that's one person being asked that.
Father?
Yeah, so I think the case of resuscitation, obviously they can and they do ask, but it's not the whole of the moral analysis is not summed up by simply asking what people want. I think a lot of times people say, well, if I say I don't want CPR, then that ends the discussion. And it's like, well, it's true that if you refuse CPR, they can't do it to you against your will. But that doesn't mean that you, by refusing CPR, have always made the right choice. In other words, you may have had an obligation in the presence of God to do CPR or to have a particular surgery. God may have had a plan here for you to live longer, and you just made a decision on your own that didn't, in fact, weigh things carefully or appropriately. So I just, you know, start with that observation that I think a lot of times we say, well, as long as we ask somebody, then we've sort of resolved the ethics. And it's more than that that has to go into it. It's both they have to choose, but they need to choose in accord with real goods that are at stake. So for the back to the case of the pregnant mother, the mom died. Could they have asked her ahead of time? I'm convinced that if a mother were to say, well, you know, if I become brain dead, I definitely don't want you to do anything on behalf of my baby. I don't want you to, you know, try to help my baby or, you know, deliver my baby. I don't want you to do anything for my baby. I think that would be a situation that would, in that very moment, necessitate that we sit down and say, no, wait a minute. Okay, why are you adopting a position like that? If it's clear that your child could benefit and could even come to see the light of day, why are you saying you don't want us to try to help your baby? And, you know, sometimes there'll be other issues then that could be ferreted out and discussed and worked through. And the mom would say, oh, I see. Well, yeah. Okay. Yeah. I understand how you're, there's just sort of, I think, a visceral and sometimes a fear-driven component. And whenever our ethical decision-making turns into fear-driven decisions, that decision is likely to be a very bad one, one that is not in alignment with the real moral duties that we have in the presence of the Lord and in the presence of the real goods that we're called to safeguard. So I think, you know, it's perhaps something that could be discussed with parents ahead of time, but it's such an unlikely, such a rare scenario to have what happened in Georgia occur. I mean, you know, if you look back in the medical literature, I think there's only something like 40 or 50 cases of this in the entire world where they were able to carry these pregnancies further along to the point of successful delivery.
Richard, thank you very much. Appreciate the question. Our guest is Father Tad Boholczyk. If you have a bioethics question, you are welcome to call. If it's a hard one, if it's an easy one, whatever. Or if you have a question that you would like the answer to about how to apply ethical thinking to all this biological innovation that we're seeing, 888-318-7884 is the number. Going to Ohio, where Reggie is listening on AM 1260. The Rock. Glad you're here, Reggie. Go ahead with your question for Father.
Yeah, we had a question about the ethics of the patient-doctor relationship, and at what age is it appropriate for parents to take a back seat and let the doctor make decisions one-on-one with the child, in this case, a 14-year-old. We had been warned by another family that when they went to a visit when their child was for a well patient visit, and he had just turned 14, the doctor asked the parents to leave the room, and then he asked them if he wanted to go ahead with a certain vaccination or procedure, and just kind of said, well, you know, now you're 14, we have a one-on-one relationship, and it doesn't involve your parents anymore. And I just wanted to see what, ethically, if even if that's ethical according to our state laws, is that proper within the ethical guidelines of the Catholic teaching?
Yeah, Reggie, great question. I'm kind of floored, you know, to hear of how that played out in the situation of your own family. And I have heard of other cases like this, and I think it's a very unfortunate direction where there is a kind of presumption being made by many in the medical field that they now have rights over individuals who have not yet fully reached the point that they are able to make their own informed and best interest decisions. And I think this is what it is to be a child or somebody who is a dependent. We all acknowledge that you are not able as a child to make the kinds of decisions that are going to be for your own good all the time. And that's why parents are so critically important. They're involved in a formative endeavor that requires not just years, but even decades in some cases. So I think here the idea that the doctor has a preferential position or a better vantage point or a greater interest in the child than the mom or the dad, that's a fiction. That is a fiction. That is not true at all. And I don't think one should be constructing medical interventions based on that kind of a flawed perspective. It should always be the case, and it typically has been in law and in societal common understanding, that parents are the ones who make these kinds of decisions, especially with respect to medical interventions needed for their children, because their children are not going to be able to understand these issues. But what has sort of thrown in the monkey wrench here is the whole transgenderism agenda that has been foisted upon young people, because there has been a desire to draw them in at an early and vulnerable age and to kind of subvert then the typical path of parental protection that is meant to exist and secure the goods of the child as they go through a very, very turbulent period of puberty and sort of sexual self-awakening and uncertainty about, you know, their own identity that they may be working through. So I think, you know, the what your doctor did is striking and very much ethically out of order.
What do you think?
Well, like in the doctor's defense, if the child comes to the doctor and says, you know, the parent drops the child off and, you know, the child seeks confidential care, and again, beyond things that are life-threatening, you know, like maybe the child has a tattoo or something, and he wants to get it removed, and he seeks the doctor out confidentially, does the doctor have an obligation to or if the child asks, if I get a tattoo, how hard is it to get removed? The child to maintain a confidential relationship with the doctor and not tell the parents. if the child's 14 years old.
To me, it doesn't seem that that's appropriate, because the parents need to be part and parcel of it. Now, I mean, you're describing a situation that might describe a very dysfunctional family where parents are dropping the child off and not participating, you know, in any way in what's going on in the child's health care. And that's a sad situation. So, you know, it may be that by default, the doctor has to deal with some emerging question that the child is bringing because the parents are nowhere to be found. But that's a problem with the parents. What you described was the doctor asking you to walk out of the room and leave your child alone with him so that a new approach could be taken where you are sidelined and the child and him become the key operators in this. And I think that's inappropriate. That's certainly outside the lines of what's fitting for a child who is still a dependent.
Reggie, thank you very much for that call. It does seem to me, Father, that these things were assumed at one time. For example, that the family was a unit that had priority over almost that only in extraordinary cases would anyone have intervened to disturb the relationship between parent and child, and that kind of and maybe we went too far with
absolutely
that.
Absolutely true.
But I don't think it's commonplace anymore. I think people think that the school has the right, or the doctor has the right, or somebody else has the right that always was assumed to be the parent's right and obligation.
Yeah, that's correct. And when you have parents who are severely failing in their duties of parenting, it's still very difficult to get a court-ordered guardian to step in and take over, you know, because why? Because of the presumption that you're indicating that has been, you know, deeply entrenched in our society, which is an eminently reasonable assumption that the parents are likely to have the best interests of their children until demonstrated categorically otherwise. They're going to have their best interests at heart. So, I think we're tempted here at times to step outside those guardrails, but if we do so, we have to make sure that we have really proportionately serious reasons for doing so.
And I have to say, too, I think parents need to have the almost like give yourself permission to say, I'm not leaving my child here alone with you. Just say no. Say no to the school.
Absolutely.
Say no to the doctor. No, I'm not doing that. And let them figure out.
That's right. Have some courage here, you know?
Yeah, right. All right, got to take a quick break. Father Tad Poholchik is our guest. NCBCenter.org is where you can find out about the National Catholic Bioethics Center, or you can call right here and talk with Father Tad, 888-318-7884.
Let us help you with your question today on Catholic Answers Live.
Pope Francis tells us, becoming a priest or a man or woman religious is not primarily our own decision. Rather, it's the response to a call of love. Do you feel as if God may be calling you to religious life? If so, contact a religious order faithful to the magisterium or your diocesan vocation. For information on the priesthood or religious life, visit ewtn.com/religious life today.
Who was the first Catholic in your family? Were they evangelized by a friend, a coworker, a stranger? Did you ever think that you could be that person that God uses to save a soul? And that soul could save their family, their grandchildren, and generations to come. At St. Paul Street Evangelization, a Catholic nonprofit, we train, equip, and mobilize Catholic disciples to do the urgent work of evangelization. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization, streetevangelization.com.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. 888-318-7884 is the number. We're talking bioethics with Father Tad Poholchik from the National Catholic Bioethics Center. And if you have, by the way, I should have said this earlier, you don't have to be Catholic to call. Father's happy to help you with any kind of bioethical question that you might have. You're welcome here, 888-318-7884. Let's go to Jesus. down in Texas, listening to EWTN on Channel 130 Sirius XM Satellite Radio. And Jesus, just because you're in Texas, if you'll just let me take a minute to say that I know here at Catholic Answers, we're all praying for the families in Texas. It's so horrible, the loss of children and many other people. It's almost hard to face, but we're praying for the people of Texas. So I just wanted to say that, Jesus, you're in a place where you're all right?
Yes, sir, I am.
Okay.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, we can. Yep. Go ahead with your question for Father.
Yeah. Yes. Thank you for taking my call, and thank you for your prayers for everything going on right here. As you properly said, it's been an awful situation, and I'm impaired in a Ford, and I personally don't even want to imagine what's like, but prayers is what we need.
Okay, Jesus, thank you.
So the question that I have for Father is that in the scenario in which you have an embryo that is frozen, let's say that a woman is of age, let's make it 65, just to maybe take chances out of pregnancy, natural pregnancy, out of the question. So let's say that this woman has an embryo or two that for 40 years, and now she has a second thought. Would it be ethical to implant one of her embryos into her, knowing that the embryo pretty much has no chances of making it? And if so, would it be ethical to give the woman, either in the beginning, you know, recreate somewhat of a cycle by giving her pulses of progesterone, trying to help this pregnancy come to fruition, and then let it follow its course? I mean, chances are that it probably is not going to happen. And so if we allowed for this to happen and it doesn't take, would be almost like an indirect abortion also, knowing that we're doing this, you know, with a woman not being physically able to carry the pregnancy because of the lack of hormones to, you know, withstand a pregnancy.
Okay, well, Jesus, I think this case you're describing is tricky because you're sort of asking, is it ethical for her to try to do this, knowing it's not likely to work? And the whole process here of dealing with the frozen embryos is plagued with ethically troubling steps. So, you know, just to give you an example, let's say you have 10 frozen embryos in a particular vial, and you're thinking to yourself, what should we do with them? You know, we've got 10 volunteers out here who are willing to implant them. Or we've got, you know, if they all belong to one family, we've got a mother who's willing to be implanted with all 10, maybe in the circumstances you're describing. But, you know, in the very process of thawing out those embryos, 5 of them are probably going to perish just from the thawing out. So the question becomes, you know, is it right to be doing something, taking a step that you know is going to cause a 50% mortality rate to a sizable group of young humans? Probably not. Now, you know, it's a very awkward situation that they're frozen in the first place, but these are the kinds of moral dilemmas that come up once we cross the fundamental moral lines and start doing in vitro fertilization. So would it be ethical for a 60-year-old or a 65-year-old, as you're saying, even if you're taking steps to try to initiate a cycle for her and make this work? I think my general approach here is to say, as I mentioned on the earlier call, that I don't believe the church supports this particular step of in vitro fertilization. I mean, it's absolutely crystal clear that the church always teaches that it's wrong to make life in a petri dish. But once you have that life in the petri dish or in the freezer, is it wrong to do an implantation step? And I'm convinced that if you read that section 19 of Dignitas Personae closely, it actually is making a kind of nuanced but strong argument that no, this is not something that should be done. And this, I think, would apply equally to the case of even a woman who is the mother of those embryos in the sense that she donated her egg and maybe her husband donated the sperm, or at least she donated the egg, even if it was a stranger's sperm, that, you know, there'd be some sense in which you'd say it was her children and she should be able to implant them. I'm not convinced that that's actually correct. You know, you have disrupted the moral order so profoundly here that the question actually becomes one of, are you committing some kind of an intrinsic evil by doing this, by pirating her body in a way that is outside of the marital embrace? Are you utilizing her instrumentally and objectifying her gestatory capabilities, granted for a good reason, that these poor embryos have been abandoned in the deep freeze, but I'm convinced you're carrying out a second moral wrong by taking that next step. That has always been my position. And, you know, I've argued that, I've done debates on this around the country, and it you know, we're all looking for a resolution to the tragedy of the frozen embryos, but I always stress to people, don't focus so much on what we should do with the frozen ones. Ask the question, how can we stop the assembly line production? Because even if you were to rescue, you know, 5-10 of these embryos, find women, the machinery that's generating so many of them, thousands of them every year, it goes on unabated. We need to pass laws that will restrict IVF and prevent the production of extra embryos. And in Italy and Germany, they have laws like that on the books that don't allow you to make extra embryos. The U.S., it's the wild west of infertility. As long as the customer wants it and is paying, then it's good to go. And the golden rule in vitro fertilization is that if it makes gold, it's good. You know, I think that's what's important here.
Okay, Jesus?
Yes, can I ask a follow-up there?
Please do. Go ahead.
Yeah, so obviously the initial wrong was the in vitro conception, correct? So and you're correct. I mean, Italy allows you only, like, maybe two, I believe it is, at a time. I mean, and here in the U.S., not only you're making sometimes 10 or 15, I mean, now we have the adoption of these embryos, and which has created a new business in this country, that they're already making money and making the embryos. Now they're making even more money by selling these embryos to people who want to adopt it, which is pretty expensive as well. So I guess my question was mainly towards the mother, who actually is the actual mother of the embryos, not trying to adopt them. And then this woman is trying to make it right by saying, okay, I created 10, I used only 5, and I don't want it. So it will be better, I guess, to leave the embryos frozen, I guess, and leave it as such, rather than this mother maybe attempting some sort of, you know, pregnancy, high potential failure.
Yeah, I mean, Jesus, I think so. You know, there's a desire to make things right here, but the problem is, once you've crossed certain lines, there's a kind of irreversibility to the situation that you've created. I also often think about the case of a mother who's had an abortion. You know, she would give anything to be able to reverse and undo the abortion that she had, you know, maybe years earlier. But she can't. There's an irreversibility that plagues disordered moral choices. And the deeper we go in, when we're dealing with fundamental moral goods, as we are in the creation of life itself, we have to, you know, recognize that there is not going to be a way sometimes to make it right, despite our desire to do so. And so I think the best we can do is what I alluded to before the break, that parents should continue to pay the bill to the clinic that's keeping their children frozen as a kind of sign of their care on behalf of their children, because that's the only way they can show care for their frozen children, is to continue to pay the bill. And they say, well, how long do I have to do that? That seems pretty awkward. It is awkward, but I mean, this is what sin does. It makes very, very awkward outcomes and situations. And I say, you know, I don't know how long you should do it for, but bring it to prayer before the Lord. If I were in that situation, I think I would set up a trust fund and fund it so that even after I were gone for a few years, there would be money to protect my embryonic children. And then maybe, you know, maybe there will be some solution later that will come to the fore. But I kind of doubt it. I mean, some people say, what about artificial uteri? What about gestating an embryo completely in a machine? Couldn't we do that? And I think there's all kinds of problems with that, and I doubt that that's going to first be technically possible. Pregnancies are very, very complicated realities. But I think it's unlikely that'll be morally acceptable either.
Jesus, thank you very much. Thanks to everybody. Hey, Mark Brumley's coming up. You're welcome to call. It's Ask Me Anything, 888-318-7884. Father Tad Poholchik from the National Catholic Bioethics Center has been our guest. Father, may we and our listeners have your blessing before we go.
Yes, of course. May Almighty God bless you in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit. Amen.
Thank you so much, Father. I always enjoy the time with you so much.
Well, thank you. I enjoy it with you as well, Si. Just wonderful program.
Check out FatherTad.com. Find out what Father Tad's up to. Check out the writing, the videos, all of it. You don't have to go to Father Poholchik. Just go to FatherTad.com. Right back with Mark Brumley on Catholic Answers Live.